Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Sorry for the brief interlude there. I was in a new building, and I noticed that I was freezing even with a sweater on. Went to try to adjust the temperature so it would be tolerable and I wouldn't turn into an icicle here. Kirk, one of the things that Scott and Larry did extremely well during my drive across the country is just talk about and the fact that the deal that he is offering us is so enormously appealing and that there is no better option. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was thinking about the fact that if you look at what Paul is offering, there are those who might say, well, you know, Paul's deal's pretty appealing. He just says all you got to do is believe, and you don't have to do anything else. Now, what could be more appealing than simply believe? You don't have to get to know someone. You don't have to learn anything. You don't have to understand anything. You don't have to do anything. Simply believe.
Or
so
you just believe
then Yahweh's deal be better than Paul's?
Let's think about that a minute. You can just have an imaginary somebody you believe in, and there's no relationship there. So if all it was to get to heaven, we'd all like to cry. You know, we all want to crawl out of the lake. We don't want to drown. But if all it was just to get saved, then you don't have much beyond that. That's pretty shallow. So if it's not a relationship, what do you have?
I view it as two things. One is that he is offering a lifeline out of the swamp.
Right.
Unfortunately, the lifeline that he is offering out of the swamp is not attached to anything. So rather than treading water in the swamp, rather than trying to swim out of the swamp, rather than trying to fend off the alligators in the swamp, you're going to be grasping at this line that he has thrown that isn't attached to anything.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden now you're relying on something that is wholly unreliable, which means you're going to be victimized by all of the negativity associated with that swamp. So the first problem with Paul's option of simple faith is that it's unreliable. I think that one of the things that is the most criminal is false hope. When you offer people false hope, an example of that would be where somebody says, if you trust me to run the economy, I'm going to resolve our national deficit, and I'm going to give everybody free health care and free retirement and free education, and we'll balance the budget. Well, that's all false hope. And so when you do that and you're providing people this something that they choose to believe that proves to be unreliable, I think what you've done is a tremendous disservice. It's the whole nature of religion. You know,
Islam.
This idea you're promising people heaven, and you go to their funeral and say, well, he's up in heaven now. God just took him because he really wanted to be with them, and find out, no, they're not in heaven.
Yeah.
That's false hope. That's a terrible thing.
It's a horrible thing. My primary reason I called was I wanted to just talk a minute about Psalm 91 that you hit the other, few days ago before your trip. And we had a lot of sermons on 91. That was a favorite when I was a Christian. And the trouble is, they reconcile that these promises are yours to claim based on Matthew saying that everything that is in him and everything that was in the Torah was yours to claim as well, which is ironic when you think that most Christianity rejects the Torah anyway. So, there's a disconnect there. But that's how the sermon was. These wonderful promises in 91 that he offers us to protect us are yours to claim. But it depends on whether you're part of his family or not. Then of course, everyone claims they're part of his family. So that's false hope, obviously, there, too, because we all thought we were.
It's amazing. It is amazing that even as you read the Dead Sea Scrolls presentation of Psalm 91, which is it's a gut check. I want to tell you, it's really a gut check, because I had, in the things that I have translated previously, I have found that there was nothing worse than Yashaya, you know, the book that we have the entirety of in the Dead Sea Scrolls. We have we have the entirety of the Isaiah Scrolls, called the Great Isaiah Scroll, from beginning to end. It's the only Dead Sea Scroll where the entire scroll exists in one document. And because so much of that was directed, A, against religion, and B, towards the role that Yahweh was going to play leading us from the religious and political world that we find ourselves into his home, that rabbis, in their desire to create their religion, through the Masoretes, edited one word in 14. So beyond just the improper vocalizations, beyond the removal of Yahweh's name and replacing it with the Lord, one out of every 14 words is changed in Isaiah to hide the truth from religious Jews. But in Psalm 91, it's half the words.
Really?
It's half the words. Oh, it's just, I've just never seen, I've never experienced anything that was as inconsistent in the Hebrew. In the Hebrew, the worst that I ever experienced was Yashaya, where it was one word in 14. You know, when you turn to the Christian New Testament, you expect what I'm seeing in Psalm 91.
Yeah.
But so Psalm 91 has is not only radically different in the Dead Sea Scrolls than it is in the Masoretic text. It is the psalm that is claimed by so many. You know, it introduces that, you know, Christians claim it and rabbinical Jews claim it, and you know, people all walks of life claim Psalm 91.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is that in the rewording of Psalm 91 to make it consistent with the Dead Sea Scrolls, the attitude of the individual is so hugely different than it's presented in the Masoretic. The Masoretic, it's just, you know, if you were under the shadow of the Almighty, then, you know, you're protected by him, and, you know, the people are going to die, and you're going to be protected, and, you know, ain't that wonderful?
And pestilence.
Well, yeah, in the Qumran scrolls, that's not the way it reads. What it says is it's the individual who is motivated to declare that Yahweh is not only trustworthy, but he's unchanging.
Mm-hmm.
What it means, there can't be a New Testament.
No.
You can't have a religion of Christianity replacing a religion of Judaism when the declaration is that Yahweh and his word are one, and that they are dependable because they are unchanging, and the person that's protected is the individual who recognizes and announces to God that I've come to the conclusion that Yahweh, you are unchanging, which makes you dependable, and that you and your word, your testimony, are one, and it's through this recognition of you and your word being one and the same, unchanging and renewing, that the individual is protected.
Mm-hmm. And even in the book, the letter from Matthew, Matanyahu, he's talking about you can claim a problem, but he's talking to people who are followers of the way who already recognize that to begin with. So when he's saying you can claim these promises, he's not talking to Christians. He's talking to followers
Correct.
Of the way.
Well, first of all, when you know who Yahusha is, you know that he is the corporeal manifestation of the Word. He is the Word made flesh. So, if you know who he is, if you recognize who he is, then you recognize that Yahweh and his Word are one. Yahweh and his Word collectively save, and so the declaration one makes about Yahusha is equivalent of as a declaration one would make about Yahweh and his word, saying that they are dependable because they're unchanging, and that his testimony and his nature are absolutely unified, one and the same.
And totally consistent.
And totally consistent. In fact, Yahusha, since Yahusha is Yahweh honoring his promises, Yahusha is the living demonstration of the 91st Psalm.
Right.
And so if you view Yahusha from the perspective of the 91st Psalm, then all of the benefits of the Psalm are available to you. That is the reality of it. If you view Yahusha as the founder of a new religion, of the religion of Christianity, and as the person who brought in salvation through grace, as the totality of God, if you view him from that perspective, the Psalm does you no good. Mm-hmm. And he does you no good.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I read ahead a little bit and did a little study. Verse 14. And three translations that are well known from well known Bibles. He says, "I'll set him on high because he has known my name." The King James Bible. "I will lift him beyond danger, for he knows me by my name." The New English Bible. "I will protect him beyond danger, for he knows my name," which is the Revised Standard Version. None of those Bibles tell you what his name is.
That's true, because earlier in those Bibles, every single one of them went out of their way to replace his name with Lord. And so you are absolutely correct. There is none of them that provide you with his name. However, if you read it in the Dead Sea Scrolls collection, Dod, who is the author of the Psalm. So it's Dod speaking in first person about his relationship. He specifically says that his relationship and the name that he loves is Yahweh.
Yeah.
Now, Kirk, since you mentioned the 91st Psalm, let me have a review of the Psalm thus far, because you shared the fact that the psalmist, who happens to be Dod, David, the brightest man who ever lived, Yahweh's absolute favorite individual of all time, that he was claiming these benefits based upon his love and affinity for Yahweh's name. But the name is not even provided in any English translation, which means you, as a Christian, reading those translations, can't claim the benefits. But here it is from the Qumran Scrolls collection. It begins, "Of Dod, from Dod. One lives, one is actually approaches and is genuinely settled, dwelling established and restored, abiding in the protective covering, shielded, concealed, hidden, and defended in the shelter of the Most High. Continually passing through the darkness in the shadow of the Almighty, who says, in proximity to and to approach Yahweh, my trustworthy refuge, my strength, my God is the consistent one, the enduring and unchanging one, in whom I will continually trust and rely." So just the opening statement. One of the changes from the Masoretic text, which was the oldest Masoretic, is the Codex Leningradus, which is dated to about 1100 CE, to the Qumran text, which is dated to about 150 BCE, so 1300 years older, is that this protection and ability to live and endure through the darkness is afforded to those who say of Yahweh, specifically of Yahweh, that he is trustworthy, that he is consistent and unchanging, and who admit that they trust and rely on him. Now, that's going to exclude all rabbinic Jews and all Christians and all Muslims. All of them are excluded. And they're excluded because what this is inviting us to do is to engage, exposing and condemning the darkness, the darkest recesses of humanity, which is religion. This is encouraging us to explore, expose, and condemn Christianity, Islam, secular humanism, and the like. And when you're in the midst of such darkness, there is this, apart from Yahweh, there would be this sense of depression and of gloom and just, it's horrible. And what God is saying through Dode is that if you're willing to do this, which is a job that needs to be done, you know, you've got to sweep underneath the rug and expose the filth that is there. If you're willing to go into that swamp and offer people a real lifeline where you tell them, here's the dangers of the swamp, here's the disease that is spreading in this swamp, and here's a reliable lifeline. If you're willing to do that and take that risk, that Yahweh is going to protect you so long as you are willing to acknowledge and actually acknowledge that Yahweh is trustworthy and that he is your strength because he is consistent and dependable, never changing, which means there can't be a Christian religion,
no.
Which means there can't be a rabbinic Judaism because it didn't exist at this time, which means there can't be a Talmud or oral law, which means there can't be a New Testament.
No.
Or Quran.
No.
If God is consistent, then what he said in his Torah stands.
Forever.
Yep, and forever. And this also says that, speaking of Yahweh, he says that Yahweh is not only trustworthy and his strength and consistent. He says, in whom, this is Dode now speaking, in whom I continually trust and genuinely rely. And I would argue, Kirk, that it is impossible to trust someone you do not know and impossible to rely on something you do not understand.
No argument there.
So that puts us right back to, well, how do you get to know? And how do you come to understand?
Yeah, where do you
and what we're going to do? Yeah, we're going to look at the third, fourth, and fifth statement of the 91st Psalm with Kirk when we return and see how all of that works into the 10th and 11th verses. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. We've turned our attention to the 91st Psalm. The next line here, this is Dode, David speaking to us. Speaking to anyone who is reading this psalm, he says, for indeed, surely, trust, truly, reliably, he, speaking of Yahweh, will always save you. This is interesting. This save here is natsal. Natsal is equal parts observation and salvation. So the person who is being saved is by definition observant. That means they're exploring, considering, and focusing on Yahweh and his consistent testimony, which is how they've come to trust and rely. But Natsal was scribed in the Hifl imperfect. Now, the Hifl imperfect, for the Hifl stem, which establishes a relationship between the subject, who in this case is God, the subject is he, Yahweh, causes the object, which is you in this case, by you and me, us, who engage with him in the process. So those, because of the Hifl stem's influence, those who are saved are those who engage. This brings me right back to the question I asked Kirk at the beginning of the program. You jumped to the conclusion that even if Paul's offer of the lifeline of salvation through grace were legitimate, you would be deprived of the relationship because you wouldn't know the individual who was saving you. You'd have no relationship with them. You just have an express pass to heaven if what he was offering was true. And I would take that one step further. I would say that Yahweh's offer beyond the fact that it's reliable and consistent and trustworthy, and Paul's is not, beyond the fact that one is reliable and the other one is not, the one which is just easy, you get it for nothing, is far less desirable than the one that you actually have to work for. Because the work that you're doing is rewarding. The work that you're doing is gratifying. It's enlightening. The work that you're doing is observing. And I would tell you that if you went up to a blind person or went up to a deaf person and you said to that person or communicated in some way to that person, even though it is work to be observant and to read, and even though it is work to listen and to process information, if I were giving you the opportunity to see and to hear, would you like to have those things? Well, the answer is, of course. Being observant is fun. It's enjoyable. It's uplifting. It's enlightening. And coming to know Yahweh is extraordinarily rewarding. And engaging in the covenant is empowering. It's enriching. It's how we grow. You know, politicians are always saying, we need to move forward. Well, you want to move forward? Participate in the covenant. The relationship is fun. You know, I drove across country this past week. You know, on the West Coast, it's just me and my dog. You know, on the East Coast here, you know, my wife is here. Life is so much better. Relationships are wonderful. Love is a terrific thing. And so I hear what Dode is telling us is that the salvation here is afforded to those who are observant and those who engage. That Yahweh is not saving everybody. He's saving those who observe and engage. Like the conversation we had with Glenn a couple of days ago, we were talking about the this whole benefit of acting upon what God said, and for those that do, I would say there's a tremendous reward. That I know he was talking about. Speaking with Christians, and you know the thing that ultimately determines if you're going to be a Kirk or you're going to be a Paul, to use a random name, is are you going to value observing, coming to know Yahweh sufficiently to invest the time and the energy to do so, and are you open-minded? Are you willing to go where the words lead, even if they require you to let go of things you've held dear?
Mm-hmm.
And if the answer is yes, yeah. But it's a wonderful experience. So this salvation that, you know, that your King James Bible would talk about, it's only for those who engage. Mm-hmm. In fact, the engagement is the means that Yahweh uses to provide that kind of salvation. And it's salvation from the snare of the enticer.
Mm-hmm.
Salvation from the disease and plague associated with the malicious motives and destructive speech that will prevail with the devastation that is to come. And so the very thing we're being saved from is religion and politics. Can you name anything other than religion and politics where people try to snare by enticing as a plague associated with malicious motives and destructive speech?
Now, were you thinking that way when you started calling Islam a disease, you know, it should be quarantined and all, or you know, you're just on the same page with Yah so much?
I think I was just on the same page with Yah. No, this
is very complicated.
When I was first encouraged to do this, I could not read Hebrew. I could not translate Hebrew. I was required at that time, wasn't required, but at that time, I read passages from a King Iams or a New International Version or a New American Standard Bible, and they aren't going to mention the fact that DeBoer is a disease. Hmm. Now, subsequently, you know, what I've tried to do, Kirk, and I know you've tried to do the same thing, which is I've tried to the greatest of my ability to align my perspective so that it's consistent with Yahweh's. I've come to know Yahweh. I've come to know the foundation that he established in his Torah. And I choose to stand and view everything from his perspective as it's provided in his Torah guidance. And when I do that, I typically, to the extent that I do it, I view the world correctly. And so it came from that perspective, it became obvious that Islam was a disease, a crippling disease that needed to be quarantined just like Ebola.
Yeah,
and then
that description, yeah, very.
But that's true. Now let's go to what Yahweh was saying here, that the enticers, the malicious motives that of this plague that is to come. Now that I read that, because this is what I was shared when I was asked to expose and condemn Islam. At the time, I did not know that Islam was nothing more than Muhammad's personal lust for sex, power, and money. You talk about malicious motives. That's the entirety of Islam. There is nothing more to Islam than Muhammad's personal quest for sex, power, and money. And yet here it's defined, right here. There is no more deadly or destructive, debilitating disease than mankind has ever conceived other than Islam. And so now that I'm in a position where I can actually read the Hebrew and study the Hebrew, and now that I know what Islam is, I find marvelous reinforcement. And that's what you find when you study Yah's Word. The deeper you get into Yah's Word, what you find is that Yah is dependable, like Doge announcing here, because he's consistent and he reinforces everything. So what I find here is just reinforcement, which good parenting. We reinforce our children when their approach is correct, when their attitude is right. So I find reinforcement. But it goes beyond Islam. You know, the next job was exposing Pauline Christianity. And what does Yahweh call Paul?
The plague of death.
The plague of death. Absolutely. So it goes beyond, and it goes right into Pauline Christianity, that this is the plague of death. And so, yes, independently, I want to be really careful here, but independently, I came to the conclusion that religions were deadly diseases. It happens to be Yahweh's conclusion that religions are deadly diseases. The reason, the only reason, truthfully, that my assessment of religions being a deadly disease is consistent with Yahweh's is that, you know, I've invested my life trying to make my vantage point upon which I look at and analyze the world to be consistent with his. And you'd have to look long and hard to find something more deadly, more destructive, more debilitating than religion.
I don't think it's there. I mean,
I don't think it's there either.
And the political schemes of mostly religious or joined with religion or are religious. Deifying the state is no different than making up a god.
During the time of the Roman Empire, as they were going off and fighting the Persians, and they were encountering and bringing back the first exposure to the Black Plague, did more Romans die of the Black Plague or the Roman religion?
Well, more the religion, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, the plague.
When the bubonic plague and the Black Plague plagued Europe during the Dark Ages, and it was devastated Europe, and I think the numbers are like one in every four or five people in some communities died of the plague. That 20% that died of the plague is a significant number.
Yes, but
what percentage of the population, of those populations, have had their soul die as a result of the Christian religion?
I'm not sure. It wasn't close to 100%. I don't know where the little sparks were, you know, where somebody kept
right.
alive. There's no
but
real record.
Comfortably 99%?
I think that was
Yeah, lost their soul as a result of religion. And even if they had to died of the plague, their soul would have survived it if it wasn't for the religion. So the religion was vastly more deadly than was the plague. You know, Ebola is going to kill, like, 10,000 people? 10,000 people? What percentage of the population is going to die as a result of religion? So Dode writes, "For indeed, he will always save you if you engage and if you are observant." This is from That's All. "From the snare of the enticer, from the disease and plague associated with the malicious motives and destructive speech causing the devastation to come. With his inner wing, he will screen and cover you by her approach. And under his feminine wing, you will continually and genuinely find rest and comfort. His reliable and steadfast truth upon you is a shield, and his reliability and his trustworthy instruction upon you is a means for you to travel." Pause and consider this. So there's two aspects as we moved a little deeper into the psalm, Kirk, that strike me as important. Is that Yahweh is providing the basis of the statement that Yahusha makes as he approaches Jerusalem and says, you know, if only as a mother bird I could gather the inhabitants of Jerusalem under my wings and protect them. Mm-hmm. I've come to the conclusion that Yahusha didn't say anything that Yahweh hadn't previously said.
No, I think you're absolutely right there.
So this is the mother wing under the wing of the mother bird metaphor. So I think that's significant. It's just, and I'm personally convinced that if we were smart enough to make all the connections, we'd find 100% of them. The next is that while he is used in relationship to Yahweh, every aspect of this protection, of this covering, is maternal. There is no, since Yahweh chose Hebrew, since Hebrew is the language of heaven, since Hebrew is the language of revelation, there really is no chance that all of these concepts would be feminine, including the wing of the mother bird, if he wasn't speaking of A, that he has a maternal manifestation, which would be the set-apart spirit, and that B, the set-apart spirit performs these functions.
Well, if we're like him, he has to have a feminine sign when he created us. He told us that.
Yes. Yeah, he said male and female, he created them in his image. He created them. So in his image, he has to have, by that statement in the Torah, maternal and paternal aspects. And while God can be one and have both a maternal and paternal aspect of his persona, I think that the maternal and paternal manifestation of Yahweh is really essential from a Bereth covenant perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a family has to have a mother and father.
Mm-hmm.
Husband and wife and a marriage vow. So this is explaining the nurturing, protective, covering role of the set-apart spirit. And from whom do we get the garment of light?
Or from the Ruach Kodesh.
Exactly. And is Ruach Kodesh a masculine or feminine?
Feminine
is
feminine.
Concept?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, absolutely.
Always.
So, yeah, this is, by the way, the part of Yahweh's testimony that I really like. And I like a lot of it, but what I really like is that if you use the Hebrew concept of bien, which means to understand in Hebrew, but bien is while it means to understand, bien explains that you come to understand by making connections. This idea of making these connections of the covering that he's talking about in this psalm, the protection that he's talking about in the psalm, the coming near and approaching Yahweh that he's talking about, and then he moves to all feminine metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
It's those connections that I think makes this whole relationship and this journey of discovery so rewarding.
Now, I know it's in English, but, you know, you just translated as comfort, and then we have Yahusha talking about, I'll send you the comforter. I'm praying that you'll get, not praying, but I'm asking that you'll
get
the comforter sent to. I mean, so it's kind of a washing.
In fact, this says that his feminine wing, under his feminine wing, you will continually and genuinely find comfort. Deme. Yeah, and he refers to, I'm going to send you the comforter. It all fits together, and fitting it together is the fun part. That's the whole voyage of discovery. His reliable and steadfast truth upon you is a shield. So the shield, the protection, the benefit of all of this has got to be Yah's word, and nothing other than Yah's word. It's simply Yah manifesting himself through his word and reaching out to us to protect us through his spirit. This is what Dode realized. Kirk, I hope you join us tomorrow. We'll continue with this psalm.